Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to, I don't remember what number shear this is at this point, in the 18-hour shear. We're somewhere around 11, 12, something. We've been going since 6 a.m. God willing, we'll be going till midnight. You are welcome to watch in person. You are welcome to watch online. Welcome to those who are watching online. I want to thank the sponsors of the overall program, the Weinbaum Foundation, as well as Serena and David Koshitsky, who are sponsoring in memory of Riva Koshitsky, Zichrona Levracha. I also want to thank Rabbi Jonathan and Ora Ziering, who are sponsoring this shiur in particular, as well as to thank Or Chaim for hosting the 18-hour shiur, as well as Peter for doing the telecast, which I'm told by people who are watching it is still running strong as well. So thank you very much. This is the overall program as a fundraiser for our programs for university students. We have programs for the male university students here every morning, as well as for female university students over at Olpanato Roth. If you know a student who may not be connected with us yet, please let them know about it or give us their contact information. We'll be glad to get them involved. Okay. And yes, if you're looking for CME credit for this, please make sure to sign in. And we will ultimately need to send out the evaluation, the online evaluation, and have you fill that out. That's a critical part of our maintaining accreditation for these classes. So the topic for the next hour or so is assisting abortion and death. What a gruesome title. I could have come up with something friendlier. Nonetheless, that's what we're talking about. I want to stress, as I always say, but certainly when you're dealing with an issue like this, please make sure to ask your practical questions to your rabbi. Just like all practical questions in general should have a consistent response for the community, certainly when you're dealing with matters of life and death, you have to make sure that the answer is given responsibly. Okay, so here's the question that I'm hoping to address. The following I'm going to take as a given. I'm taking it as a given that there are certain types of abortion that are prohibited by halacha, by Jewish law, without going into nuances of, is an abortion ever permitted? Because the answer is yes. There are times when halacha not only permits, but even requires abortion. But we're going to be talking about abortions that are prohibited by halacha. Further, I'm going to take as a given that certain types of hastening death are prohibited. I'm not going to get into the nuances of withdrawing care, withholding care. We're talking about a prohibited form of ending somebody's life. And the question is, where halacha says, where Jewish law says that an action is prohibited, I'm not allowed to do it. But what about referring to someone else who will be the one to do it? What about taking steps that will enable the prohibited act to take place? Those are the questions that I'm looking to address tonight. I should also note, while I'm talking about this, because it just comes to mind, that there's going to be a program for doctors at Shari Shamayim on Tuesday evening, September 20th, on the topic of effective referral and the requirements for doctors and activism and what doctors are able to do. So that's at Shari Shamayim on Tuesday evening. Rabbi Straffler is organizing it. There are several speakers I know on the agenda, but offhand I don't remember exactly whom. Okay. So what we're going to talk about then is the following practical questions. Number one, explaining to a patient what the options are. Okay, the patient comes in. There's a woman who is pregnant and for whatever reason is seeking an abortion, one that halacha will not condone. So explaining to the patient what the options are is the first question. The second question is referral for the abortion, or referral for help with the suicide, which is something that, as I understand it, the new legislation requires this referral. And then number three, performing an indirect role by doing one's job during this, where one is not actually the one carrying out the abortion, one is not actually the one ending the patient's life. So the classic example is being an anesthesiologist during an abortion. So you're not aborting, but on the other hand, you are a necessary cog in the overall process. Those are the three questions that I'm looking to address. And the challenge is that the task of the Jew is not only to behave properly, that's enough of a job, but also to encourage others to behave properly. We have a mitzvah of tochacha, of instructing others. We have various mitzvahs that relate to the conduct of other people. So we have to wonder about our role in referring somebody somewhere else. At the same time, there are halachic limitations on what exactly our obligation is. This is not a new discussion. The problem of giving advice for abortion, for example, is decades old. It's been in the literature for a very long time. And that literature is what informs the discussion about effective referral for physician-assisted death as well. So that a lot of what I'm going to say is actually going to be based on a tshuva by Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, that sits Eliezer, a responsum in which he responded to Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham on the issue of medical roles that enable an abortion which the Torah will not permit. So the primary concern that people cite when dealing with this issue is the problem called lifnei iver, the biblical prohibition against causing the patient to sin. It's funny, for those who were here when we did the business ethics one earlier today, we did conflict of interest. There was also a big lifnei iver discussion about causing people to stumble. It comes up in this area of Jewish law as well. If you take a look at source number one, I gave it to you on the sheet. Lo sekalel cheresh, do not curse the deaf. Lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol, do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. V'yareisa me elokecha, you shall revere your God. Ani Hashem, I am God. A Jew is not allowed to do anything which will cause somebody else to do something negative, something harmful. I'm not allowed to lead somebody else to do something harmful, and not only directly, right? You put the stumbling block in front of the blind person, but even indirectly. And to show you how far this goes, I give you the example of source number two. Source number two is talking about the case of shepherds. The way that classically you worked, the way that classically shepherds worked, was that they would not take people's sheep on a day-to-day basis. You can imagine that's a fairly inefficient way to go about being a shepherd. Anybody think about the logistics of shepherding? Is that not a discussion here? It's not efficient to take the sheep out in the morning and take them back in the evening. It doesn't work that way. What you did instead was that you took the sheep for months at a time. And for the season, you would have them and graze them out in the wilderness. Well, that raises certain questions. What happens with whatever the sheep produce while they are away? Milk, wool, young, right? What exactly are the rules for the sheep? So the Gemara here talks about whether somebody is allowed to purchase the wool from the shepherd, or to purchase goats from a shepherd, because maybe the shepherd is in fact keeping them inappropriately. In other words, he took the animals out to graze for a few months. The animal gave birth, and either he didn't inform the owner, or he told the owner that the animal didn't make it, or whatever it is, and now he's going to sell it on the market. So source number two says, Ein lochim in aroim lo izim lo gidim lo gizim lo tlushin shel tzemer. You're not allowed to purchase goats, kids, wool, tufts of wool from shepherds. You're only allowed to buy stitched clothing from them, because you can assume that the shepherd is selling you stitched clothing. That's not from the wool that came off of the sheep this season. That's a product that the shepherd had. So what the Gemara is telling me, though, is where I have reason to suspect that the product is in fact inappropriate, that the product is stolen, I am not allowed to buy it off of the shepherd. And this is recorded as halacha. The Gemara brings it, the Rambam brings it, and so on. I'm not allowed to buy stolen goods. But it's not because these are stolen goods. The reason why I am not allowed to buy them is because I tempt the shepherd. I am going to give the shepherd an incentive for being dishonest. And that is a violation of lifnei iver. That is a violation of putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, even though I am only indirectly doing so. By buying off of the shepherd, I create a market which gives him an incentive to go out and steal, and yet I am responsible for that, and therefore I'm not allowed to buy the stolen item. That's the basic principle, is that I am not allowed to cause somebody to stumble, even indirectly, and even though the shepherd is not blind. I hope, because he wouldn't be very good as a shepherd, probably. But what I mean is, the shepherd knows you can't steal. It's not like I'm tricking him into stealing things, and yet I'm not allowed to do it. However, there is a heter, there is a leniency involved in dealing with this shepherd, and the leniency is where I am giving him information which he could have gotten somewhere else. Not the shepherd case per se, but if I give somebody information or the means of sinning, and that is information or a means of sinning that he could have gotten somewhere else, then I'm not in violation of Lifnei Yiver. I'm not considered to be putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, because he was going to stumble anyway. It wasn't about me. If you take a look at source number 3, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the Gemara asks, V'chi is lei lo avar mishum iver lo sitein mechshol, should say Lifnei Yiver lo sitein mechshol. The Gemara talks about the concern for Lifnei Yiver, the concern about causing people to stumble, not applying in a case in which the fellow already has the prohibited item anyway. In other words, I'm going to give him non-kosher food, but he already has non-kosher food. So the supposition walking into this passage from the Talmud is that if I give him the non-kosher food, but he already has some anyway, I'm not in violation. And the Gemara challenges that. And it asks, Vatanya, we have learned the following. Amar Rabbi Nassan said, Minayin shelo yoshit adam kos shalayin lenazir ve'ever menachay livnei Noah. How do you know that if there is a Nazir, a Nazirite, he has vowed not to drink wine, how do you know you're not supposed to extend to him a cup of wine? How do you know that if you have someone who isn't Jewish, one of the Noahide laws, the laws for all humanity, is not to eat flesh taken from an animal while the animal was still alive? So how do I know that if I give him something like that, I am, you know, that, how do I know that I'm not allowed to give him something like that? And they quote the verse, Lifnei Yiver lo sitein mechshol, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. So the Gemara says, the Gemara asks a question, it says, V'hahacha, d'chilo yehavinam le'shakli ihu, u'ka'avar mishum lifnei yiver lo sitein mechshol. The Gemara asks, you're telling me that I am violating the stumbling block rule if I give him a cup of wine. You're telling me I violate the stumbling block rule if I give him this food that he's not supposed to eat. But I don't understand. If I didn't hand it to him, he could get it anyway. There's no distinction. You follow what I'm, you follow what I'm saying? It's a little bit twisted. I have to make sure that this is clear because it's a key source. The Gemara says, you're trying to distinguish between where you are the sole enabler and the case in which they could have gotten it anyway. But the cases that you prohibit here are cases where they could have gotten it anyway. And yet it's prohibited anyway. So you're, what are you trying to tell me? Asks the Gemara. To which the Gemara's answer is, you know what our case is. Dekoi betray ivri nahara. The case we're talking about is where they're on two different sides of a river. Meaning, the Nazir is standing here, and I with the wine am over here. And the verb that was used was lehoshit, to extend the wine to him across the river. In other words, without me, he couldn't have done it. He didn't have access to my side of the river. I am the one who enabled it. He didn't have access to the food he wasn't supposed to eat. I am the one who extended it to him, and without my help, he couldn't have gotten it. That's where I'm going to be liable. However, if it wasn't two different sides of the river, the food is sitting there on the table. I pick up the food and say, here, made it easier for you. I'm not in violation of putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. The information, or in this case, the item, was easily accessible. That's the result of this Gemara, and Rabbi Moshe Isserles quotes it as halacha, as the law, in source number 4. I'm going to read just the English in the interest of time, but I brought the Hebrew so you can see it as well. Some say that the prohibition against selling idolatry-related items to non-Jews. Non-Jews are not allowed to worship idols. So the prohibition against selling them the paraphernalia of idolatry applies only where they lack similar items and they couldn't purchase them elsewhere. If they can purchase it elsewhere, you can sell them anything. Don't worry about it. And then he says, no, some are strict and say you're not allowed to. The practice is to be lenient. Following the first view, a person of spirit will be strict for himself. So the position taken by Rabbi Moshe Isserles is that if he could have gotten it somewhere else, I'm not in violation. Clear? Yeah.
What about human animals for cosmetics? I'm not talking about medicine, cosmetics.
Mm-hmm.
Or using animals.
Right. What is that? How does that connect here?
It says that if you use the animals, they use them in a society where animals are not naturally, animals are naturally in the wild, and if we use them and close them in, and use them for our needs.
Right.
Is that like
I think that may be a separate problem. I wouldn't go into Lifnei Iver. The question there is it wrong for me to experiment on them in the first place? In other words, there I am doing the act. What we're talking about here is where I'm not going to violate the transgression, I'm just going to enable somebody else to do so. And the question would be, I guess the question really that you're asking, I would ask the question this way. Let's presume for a moment something which isn't necessarily true. Okay, so I'm saying right out, this is not necessarily true, but let's pretend for a moment that the animal experimentation is inappropriate. And there is somebody who conducts such experiments. Am I allowed to furnish animals to them knowing they can get animals anywhere? That will be a parallel to our discussion here. And that's the same type of case that we have to discuss. Yeah?
So the issue franchise, they are providing a trade service that the Jews in the city can buy anywhere.
So that's a really good question. Would a Jew be allowed then to own a McDonald's? So there are other nuances that make that case challenging, which is, among other things, the question of whether a Jew is allowed to make money off of non-kosher food in general. In other words, forget where there are going to be Jewish customers. No Jewish customers. I know that I am in an area where my clientele will be 100% non-Jewish. I still might have a problem. Depending on whether it's meat and milk, depending on whether it's my sole source of support. So you add, there are other complications that are involved, but it's the same sort of a question, so much so that the Chalkes Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Breisch, I think, brought up this idea as a basis for permitting vending machines to be open on Shabbos. Right? The question is, I have a vending machine. It's on some street somewhere. Presumably, Jews may go buy from it also on Shabbos. Do I have to worry? And the answer is, if he doesn't buy from my vending machine, he's going to buy from somebody else's vending machine. What's the difference? So, same principle, but the McDonald's has certain nuances that make it different. So, that's the basic idea. And the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg used this concept in source number 5 regarding the question of carrying out medical exams that are a necessary preliminary to an abortion. Right? If I am a radiologist and they need to do certain scans in order to know whether to go ahead or not go ahead, so Rabbi Waldenberg wrote the following in source number 5. He deals with a tangential issue, which I shouldn't have included in the source, an issue of the Mishnah Lamelech. I didn't want to really go into the Mishnah Lamelech. The Mishnah Lamelech has a discussion about what if you could find somebody else to do it, but that other person is also prohibited from doing it. So, in other words, what if the other radiologist is also a Jew? So how did that figure into the whole discussion of Lifnei Iver? I didn't want to get sidetracked on that, particularly because the weight of many halachic authorities is not to side with the Mishnah Lamelech that this is a concern. So I'm skipping to the middle of the source number 5. Therefore, one whose job makes him responsible to execute preparations in these three cases, the cases of doing the tests, has broad support to say that he is not violating Lifnei Iver. He won't be considered to be violating this prohibition against putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Now, there are two limitations for this lenient. Oh, I see what I did. I put the Mishnah Lamelech after. That wasn't right. Okay. There are two limitations for this leniency. Limitation number one for the leniency is the Mishnah Lamelech's question of, what if I'm going to go to somebody else who is also prohibited from doing it? What if the other option is some other Jew? And that's what I brought you in source number 6, but I'm not going to go into it because I really didn't want to. But I see that I mentioned it on the sheet, so now you know what it's doing there on the page. But the other consideration that's part of this discussion is, what if you are giving him a better option than he would have with you? What if you're giving him a better option than he would have without you? Mistake in my notes. That he would have without you. In other words, let me give you the case that this comes up with. Rav Yorah Bachrach, the Chavos Yair, had the following story. A guy approached him with the question. He has a shlachta, so they shecht. What do they do with their non-kosher meat? They give it to this non-Jewish fellow. He has a good business arrangement with him. He knows him well. He gives him the non-kosher meat. Every time they shech something and it doesn't go right, this fellow gets it. One day, this non-Jewish fellow marries a Jewish woman. So now the question is, can I continue to give it to him knowing that he's going to share it with his wife, and his wife is Jewish, and she should not be eating the non-kosher food? So the question is, well, it's not as though she cares about kosher or non-kosher food. If she doesn't get it through you, she's going to get it somewhere else. It's not like she married this non-Jewish fellow and she's going to keep a kosher kitchen. So in the Chavos Yair's day, that didn't happen. So then the question is, are you allowed to continue providing it, or can you say, well, she'll get it somewhere else. She doesn't get it from me. She'll get it from somewhere else. And his answer is very interesting, because Rabbi Yair Bachrach, in this Chavos Yair's, says that you are giving it to them in, you know, much cheaper than they can get it elsewhere. And therefore the justification of, well, they could get it somewhere else, doesn't apply. If what you are giving them is higher quality, or what you are giving them is at a cheaper cost, then what you are giving them is unique and not replaced by what they get somewhere else. This has clear applications to our questions, right? What if you say, well, I'm going to give them advice on how to get an abortion, right? But I'm a better doctor than the other people they're going to go to. I'm going to give them, you know, my unique insight. I am not justified by saying, well, they could get the information elsewhere. Because what they're getting from me is not what they would get elsewhere. Jack, you have a question?
As physicians,
yeah.
Sorry, we're obligated to provide on-call services,
yep,
and including Shabbos. And I was told that I could trade on-call, my on-call, but I couldn't find a non-Jew with a Jew.
Yeah.
Because they were Jews that I knew weren't keeping Shabbos anyway. So is that the favor, or?
So that's its own discussion, which I'm afraid to get into while I'm on camera. Without having, you know, properly reviewed, I gave a shiur on it a while back, and if you email me, I can send you, you know, notes from the shiur, but I haven't looked at it in a while. It's a little bit more of a complicated discussion actually there, because if your call involves saving lives, right, then then what you're doing is you're actually, you know, it's even better. In other words, it's good that you gave it to the non-observant Jew who will now observe Shabbos and save lives on Shabbos, you know, as opposed to what else, you know, might have happened where you're leading them into, yeah. So it's a longer discussion than we can do right now. But that's in terms of lifnei iver. The idea is I am not causing them to stumble if they would have stumbled anyway. Assuming that, they would have stumbled equally, no matter where they were. Clear? But lifnei iver is not the only part of this conversation. There is a separate prohibition which you have to be cognizant of. And that's called misayeya. Misayeya literally means, what? Anybody know? Sorry? Assisting. Right. Assisting somebody. Helping somebody to do something that is wrong. You're giving them a step in doing something that is inappropriate. What exactly is the nature of the prohibition against misayeya, against assisting? So that's subject to some debate. Surprise. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Comment of Tosfos on the Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos is talking about the case. They're dealing with issues of transport on Shabbos. You know that on Shabbos, one is not supposed to transport from a private domain to a public domain to a private domain, and so forth. So they discuss the case in which you're standing inside the house, somebody else is outside the house, and you put something into their hand, or they put something into your hand. You're transporting back and forth between the two areas, the public area and the private area. So one of the questions that should come up, and this is what Tosfot, writing in the 12th/13th century, discusses, is the question of, in the event that I give the item to this other fellow, who's then going to transport it, am I violating lifnei iver? Am I guilty of putting a stumbling block in front of the blind? And Tosfot writes, take a look at number 7, even where the sinner could take the item himself, it's not in his hand yet. He could take it out of my hand and transport it, so therefore I didn't do anything that he couldn't have done himself. So I'm not in violation of lifnei iver, such that one does not violate lifnei iver, right? Because he could pick it up himself. I didn't add anything. Nonetheless, he says, a rabbinic prohibition remains. For one must separate him from violation. You are supposed to keep people from sinning. And he calls that a rabbinic violation. That's called afrushe mei sura, is the technical term, which gets connected with this idea of miseyeya, of actually helping somebody sin. The opposite of separating them from sin is that you're actually assisting in this regard. So the nature of this rabbinic prohibition, according to some, is part of the general principle of lifnei iver. In other words, if I am not supposed to put a stumbling block in front of the line, in front of the blind, leading them to sin, then I'm certainly responsible not to help them in sinning. Right? It's just, it's logical. Another approach is a logical extension of the mitzvah of tochacha. There is a mitzvah for every Jew to educate others. Right? This is why we insist on telling other people what to do. It's a mitzvah, so there. So, if that's a mitzvah to tell people, then I'm certainly obligated not to cause people to sin. Another view from the Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov HaLasvili, I brought it here in source number 8, the Hebrew's on one side, the English is on the top of the other side. And he says it's a function of the principle, Kol Yisrael Arevin Zebadeh. We are all Jews are guarantors for each other. We are responsible for each other. If I'm responsible for the other, then how in the world am I allowed to help them sin? Tell me it's not lifnei iver. I didn't cause him to stumble any more than he would have stumbled without me. But I still helped him to sin. I helped him to do something that was inappropriate. This has all sorts of applications. One application goes back to our vending machine on Shabbos case. And the Mishnah Halachas, Rav Menashe Klein, argues that even though it's not lifnei iver to keep the vending machines running on Shabbos, it is misayaya. You're helping people to sin. You gave them the goods. You didn't give it to them, you sold it to them. But still, you provided the means of sinning. He doesn't like the idea of keeping the vending machine running on Shabbos. It comes up in all sorts of areas in Jewish law. However, so the thing is, you set it up before Shabbos, and the profit is happening mamela. The profit is happening, you know, on its own. That would be the justification for it. You could also argue maybe he takes the Shabbos profits and gets rid of them, but he wants the machine to be functioning so that people will come, because otherwise, if they know it doesn't work, sometimes they won't go, and so forth. So that's the misayaya concern. So what are you going to do about this issue of helping people? Right? Helping people is a terrible thing sometimes. So the answer is that there are leniencies when it comes to misayaya as well. There are several. I'm just going to bring a few of them that are most relevant to the cases that we have to address. Right now we're just outlining principles, and then we have to get to the cases that are involved. So, one potential leniency brought by various halachic authorities is that misayeya, the problem of assisting, is only an issue during the actual violation of the prohibition. During the violation itself. So, for example, take a look at source number 9. They're talking about a concern about working with somebody who is going to harvest produce in Israel and process it in a way that is inappropriate. So the source says, one may neither trample nor harvest grapes with a Jew who processes them in impurity. Okay, the impurity is the impropriety here. So you're not allowed to harvest the grapes with him. You're not allowed to trample the grapes with him. But one may bring barrels to the press with him, the empty barrels. You're allowed to do that. And you could bring the barrels from the press with him once the trampling is over. Why is that okay? It's still misayaya, you're still assisting. No, we're assuming it's a prohibited level of impurity. That's a given in the case. The answer is, it's okay because it's not when he's doing the wrong. The sin is in contaminating the grapes. If I help him before that, or if I help him after that, that's not during the transgression itself. That's one source of leniency, which is brought by the Nitziv in his Meshiv Davar, his brother the Tzitz Eliezer, quoting the Ksav Sofer, the Binyan CLA. Many authorities bring this as a leniency. The impropriety is causing impurity for produce in Israel, and as long as you don't help while he is actually doing that, everything else is fine.
Is that the same logic as the radiologist?
So, we're going to get to the applications. Right now I'm just doing principles, but yes, that will be brought into play. The second of the leniencies is where what you are doing is only a background step. What you are doing is not the actual deed. What you're doing is a background step. So, for example, the Maharsham, Rabbi Shalom Mordechai Shwadron, dealt with this question. The question put before him in 19th century Poland was, I have a storefront. It's available for rent. A Jew wants to rent it from me, and he's going to keep the store open on Shabbos. Am I allowed to rent the store to a Jew who's going to leave the store open on Shabbos? And his answer was yes. He writes here in source number 10, part of what is a longer response. It also appears that wherever there is a prohibition against assistance, like we're talking about, not helping somebody to sin, that is only where this person will use the actual item one gives him for the prohibition. However, here he will only perform his prohibition in the home's airspace. Meaning the house, not really at home. And the house is airspace. Meaning, I gave him a facility, but it's not the facility that he's using. It's the merchandise that he has within it. It's the cash register that he brought into the store. It's the terminal for the credit card payment. That's where, this is just the environment in it. So because it's only the environment, I am really only providing a background step. That's the second leniency. Yeah?
Would that apply if he was only renting it on Shabbos, not the rest of the week?
Would it apply if he was only renting it? So I didn't have havla'a anymore of the absorption of it into the weekday proceeds. Is that why you viewed it different? Right, so that may create a separate problem of whether I'm allowed to rent something for Shabbos alone. Right, that may be a separate question.
But for this purpose, it's...
I'm not sure I'd see that it is as applying for this purpose, but it may be a separate problem in terms of the rental. The third, I'm not sure because I have to think it through, but I don't see that as affecting this. The third potential leniency on this is where it's done for your benefit. Okay, as in the case that we're talking about here is that somebody has a particular job. He's doing it for his salary. He's doing it for his job. Because the principle then is that in the event that you're doing it for your personal benefit and you would suffer a loss by not doing it, then you're allowed to rely on what's called tiliyah. Tiliyah, relying on, in this case, an unlikely possibility. I'll give you an example outside the realm of this conversation. I invited you to come to my house for dinner Friday night. The Jew lives, I don't know, a kilometer away. Right? They could easily walk. It's a 10-minute walk. But I know that they normally drive on Shabbos. Am I allowed to invite them to come to my home for a dinner on Shabbos, knowing full well that they're likely to drive? Or do we say no? You can't because they're going to drive. So that's the concept of taliyah. Whether I am able to say, well, you know what? They probably walk. Can I say that? What if it's not a kilometer? What if it's a kilometer and a half? What if it's 2 kilometers? Where is your boundary for making such suppositions? So I'm not at all addressing that topic right now. I'm only using it to introduce the idea of being toleh, making this assumption. So the Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenberg quotes the Ramban, which I brought you here in source number 11, who say that in the event that what we're talking about is your personal benefit from it, maybe you could rely on the possibility that the person is not going to sin. In other words, I'm going to do the ultrasound, and then they won't follow through. They're going to decide that they're not going to abort after all. There's a fascinating piece by Rav Warman, Rav Shlomo Warman, dealing in the days before 9/11, back in the days when airline tickets were transferable. So the question was, you're a travel agent. Are you allowed to sell somebody a ticket for a Shabbos flight? So you sell a Jew a ticket for a flight on Shabbos. And one of the points that he makes in this article is, well, you know what? Maybe they're buying it, but they're going to transfer it to somebody else. They're not actually going to fly. That was the art today. I think that doesn't work. But that's a third potential leniency. And then the fourth leniency, which I don't want to go to in great depth, is the point that, again, if you're dealing with someone who is a mumar, somebody who violates things all the time, do you have to really worry about it? So that's misayeya. We have lifnei iver, don't cause people to stumble, which may be mitigated by the fact that the information is available elsewhere at an equal quality, equal availability, equal cost. The second concern is misayeya. Are you assisting them in a sin, which is probably a rabbinic prohibition, and may have leniencies where you're helping before or after the actual sin takes place, or you are providing only a background step, Or you're doing it for your own benefit, for your salary, for your job, and it's possible that that this other person wasn't going to take advantage of your assistance. There's a third very short category that I want to just mention, because it's worth noting, called Mahzik Yidei Ovrei Avera, to grip the hands of those who are transgressing. And what we mean by that expression, to grip the hands, what we mean is encouraging people in wrongdoing. I'm walking down the street on Shabbos, and I see my Jewish neighbor mowing the lawn, or watering the grass, or something along those lines, something you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. So it's one thing for me to say good morning. It's another thing for me to say, wow, what a beautiful garden. What a great job you're doing. That's called machzik yedei ovrei avera. That's called gripping the hands of, encouraging somebody who is transgressing. And that's its own discussion. I'm not applying it here really, because really the only application of it in our discussion would be if you were to say, I think you're making the right move. Right? That would be where this would be a problem. To say to somebody, yeah, this is the path you should follow, that's where you would get into the issue of machzik yedei ovrei avera. Okay. So let's look at our cases now, right? We've been talking for 35 minutes. I think it's time to actually deal with something medical. Now that we've outlined our major concerns. So in terms of explaining the options, the first case, just telling them information. This is how one would go about this. So is it lifne iver? If you outline the options? No, it's not with neighbor. Why not? Right. That doesn't stop it from being with neighbor. What? Yeah.
So you also give options that are not collectively problematic. That's up to them to choose.
Well, that doesn't help me, though, because I gave them options that are problematic. It's true that it's up to them to choose. That will help me in terms of misayaya, but it won't help me for lifne iver. What helps me for lifne iver?
We can go on the internet and look for all the options themselves.
Right. They don't have to come to me. They can get it online. All the stuff I'm telling them is readily available elsewhere, assuming that that's true, which isn't a given. But assuming that, I restrict myself to the information that they could get anywhere. Assuming that I can do that and not run afoul of the law and so on and so forth, that would be the way for me to avoid lifnei iver. It's not misayaya. I'm not helping them, because this is at most a background step, and it's not during the transgression. I should note something very important, and I'm taking the moment here to say this using source number 12. The fact that we say that lifne iver does not apply does not mean that this is a good thing to do. We are not happy about the idea that you are going to convey information which will aid somebody in doing something we believe is wrong. I brought you source number 12. It's a fascinating piece. I only brought you a brief part of it, but you can look at the web link there to see the rest of it. This is published by the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. This particular piece was written by Rabbi Moshe Tendler and Dr. Fred Rosner, as I believe, were the authors, with the approval of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. The question that was asked of them was, are you allowed to give contraceptive advice to a single woman? Are you allowed to give her advice on how to avoid having a child? Clearly what you are doing is giving her the means to enter into some relationship with somebody.
Yeah. Already
in a relationship.
Right. If you don't provide the information, they may end up pregnant and then back in your office asking for an abortion.
Right. So take a look at the way they worded this. Except under very exceptional circumstances, Judaism considers it immoral for the physician to give contraceptive advice to an unmarried girl. That's their opening statement. Comment. The doctor must use judicious moral judgment in the sensitive area of human relations. Judaism deems it immoral to give contraceptive counsel to unmarried persons when such advice may serve to remove an important barrier to immoral conduct. In other words, those last words, I think, are not just there. I think they make an important point. What are the alternatives here? If they don't get the advice from you, are they going to do this anyway? You're not removing a barrier to moral conduct. All you're doing by failing to help them is, causing the next question to be abortion. Now, keep in mind again, this is the 1970s. The environment is different in terms of getting the information in the first place for them. And therefore, the issue of where is it available and can they get the advice from somebody else, I think is different from what you'll see 40 years down the road. But I don't really want to get into the contraceptive discussion because I think it does involve nuances like what you're mentioning. It involves greater complications, frankly, than anybody was thinking about in the 1970s, right? The STD discussion is also, I think, part of this conversation. But the point that I want to stress by bringing it is the moral component of it. The fact that something is not a violation of the law doesn't mean it's a good thing to do. You have to be very careful when assessing these, and a person who does it should not necessarily feel good about it. Okay. There's more. When you look at the original source online, you'll see there's more to it that also doesn't fit the current day.
So it brings a strong comparison to the main legislation.
Yeah.
Because assistance is not widely available. It's not widely known. It's not easy to get.
Right.
And so there's a lot more of all these items. The Amena, what it'll be in 40 years is a different story. But the Amena, it's a major problem.
Correct. So Dr. Kirshen makes the point that we may be looking at, when it comes to medical assistance in dying, we may be looking at 1970s discussions about contraception. That in fact may be analogous in terms of availability of information. I mean, the internet is going to move things a lot faster than it moved with contraception in terms of information and sharing of information and people finding out what's available. You will know better than I will about that. So, I cede that question to you. But in terms of explaining the options, that's what you have to ask. That's the question you have to ask. If I don't tell them, what will they know or not know? Yeah.
Does this discussion apply to Jews and non-Jews equally, or will it be Jews?
So we're talking Jews and non-Jews. The prohibition against l'fnei iver, putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, applies uniformly, Jews and non-Jews. If you remember the Gemara in Avodah Zarah that we saw in the beginning, the two cases that they gave were giving the wine to the Nazir and giving the piece of meat, the Eiver Menachai, to a non-Jew. Right? So yeah, no, it applies for everybody. Jew and non-Jew alike, you're not allowed to cause somebody to stumble, which will include, for the non-Jew, his Noahai laws, which include not to take a life. So yes, abortion is also nuanced in that case in terms of what is prohibited and permitted for non-Jews. So what about referral? What happens when we get to the issue of referral? Well, it's still not l'fnei iver if somebody else could legitimately do it, right? The same point applies. And it's still not misayeya. You're still not considered to be assisting because you're not juring the deed. At most, you're simply providing information. So assuming that they couldn't get this information from someone else, but it's not now information, now it's a referral. Assuming they couldn't get this referral from somebody else, my understanding, my limited understanding, is that getting a referral is not easy right now. That there are many who are refusing to participate. What's going to happen, because the law, as I understand it, is requiring referral.
Regulation from the college, not the law.
Okay, fair enough. But since you're bound by regulation from the college in order to be able to practice as a physician, does that matter?
You have to read the exact words, because the exact words was "or agency."
Okay.
And agency, it's not a physician.
So
it's even more. It's even more indirect.
Well, let's ask the question this way: there is somebody who is a family physician. Right? He has a patient who comes to him and says, I would like to, he has somebody who comes to him and says that I want information on medical assistance in dying. Not only I want information, I want a referral. Right? That's what the person says. Under the current statement from the college or whoever is regulating this, what is that physician going to be required to do?
The least he's required to, or she is required to do, is explain what all the steps are.
Mm-hmm.
And, in the exact words of the college, make an effective referral without delaying access to somebody who will do it or an agency.
Right.
And the agency still has to make its own determination that the person is competent, that they meet the criteria, and so, the agency is willing to do it.
Got it. So in other words, what happens for referral is that the physician is sending not to a doctor who's going to carry it out necessarily, but to an institution of some kind that has doctors on staff, and then they'll make the decision about whether to do it or not do it.
Yeah.
That's correct. Okay. So I asked this question. I sent the question to one rabbi that he was out of town, but the question ended up with Rav Asher Weiss, who, for those who know, that Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, was the posek for many years for Shari Tzedek Hospital in Israel. Rav Asher Weiss is now the halachic authority for Shari Tzedek Hospital in Israel, and he unfortunately gets these questions and questions of this gravity all the time. And his answer is actually available online. I gave you a link in source number 13 where you can download the audio of his lecture. You can hear this at 1 hour and 16 minutes into the lecture. That's where my question is put to him. And he talked about it also in the context of Montreal. He has a brother who is in Quebec, and Quebec had this issue with Bill 52 before it became a matter here. And his answer is that effective referral is permitted. And he emphasizes something else. He emphasizes that it's key to have observant Jewish physicians. It's imperative that we have doctors who know what our concerns are and who care about our halachic concerns. And so he points out as an additional factor for consideration that if Jews are going to say, I can't practice as an observant Jew and be a physician here because they're requiring me to refer, then we will have an overriding communal crisis even beyond the particular physician situation. And so he ruled that effective referral would be permitted on those grounds, separate from the calculations we've been giving. It's a very interesting point of view, coming from somebody with the shoulders to say it. The third piece of this, and last, is that performing an indirect role during the procedure, like we mentioned, the anesthesiologist during an abortion, where it's not an abortion approved by halacha. So there is basis for being stricter here. One reason for being stricter is because your connection to the Avera, your connection to the transgression, is now too close. Even though you're still not the one performing it, you're not ending the person's life, you're not performing the abortion, nonetheless, the connection is too close. Rabbi Avram Sherman in Israel talked about this issue in a separate context. The question arises, if you are the rabbi who officiates on a conversion, and it's a conversion of somebody who is not planning on observing mitzvot, have you done anything wrong? The person who is converting, or thinks they're converting, is going to be stuck one way or the other. Meaning, either the conversion is invalid, but they're going to be passing themselves off as Jewish, or the conversion is valid despite their expectations, in which case you've now converted someone who's going to eat non-kosher, who's going to, you know, violate the laws and so forth. You haven't done them any favors. Right? That's the question that comes up in this regard. So, the Mincha Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and before him Rav Kook, made the argument, I brought Rav Kook here in source number 14, that to accept such a person to convert is lifnei iver. You are putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. That was the argument that Rav Kook made. So Rabbi Sherman asked the question and said, but you're not helping them to sin. You're just converting them. They're not eating a cheeseburger while you're converting them. Then later on, they're going to go do whatever they're going to do. Why is this called putting a stumbling block in front of the blind? That was Rabbi Sherman's question. And his answer is, it's just that the link between the conversion and the transgression is too close. If you hadn't done this, then they would not have been sinning. There's nothing wrong. I'm not Jewish. You eat a cheeseburger, go ahead. You can eat them all day long. Maybe not a good idea health-wise. I'm saying this to a group of doctors, but you know what I'm saying. He hasn't violated a prohibition. Nonetheless, you can't... You're too close. And halachic authorities seem to have different views on this. And I had this very interesting question that was put to me, which I put to two different halachic authorities, and I got two different answers, which is a nightmare, but that was the story. I had reason for going to both of them. It wasn't, you know, stama. I had a reason to go to both of them. The question was the following. when they want to take the heart from somebody in order to use it for a transplant, they have to keep the body functioning until they're able to take the heart, right? At least with current medical technology. At the time that they take the heart, if you don't accept the brain death criteria, then you believe that they're ending the patient's life by taking the heart out of the body. So the question I got from an anesthesiologist was this. One of the things that some anesthesiologists end up having to do is to manage the fluids that are going into the body in order to keep the body functioning until they can take the heart. And so the question is, if his rabbi says to him that we don't accept the brain death criteria, is he involved in killing this patient by enabling the organ transplant, by enabling them to take the heart? Now, I saw two different ways you could look at this. On the one hand, you could say, yeah, you're helping them to kill the patient. On the other hand, you could say, no, you're keeping the body alive. Right? The fluids that you are managing inside the body are actually prolonging the life of the patient. If you weren't there, Dr. Anesthesiologist, the body would stop. I mean, it's a logical consequence of the brain death. It's going to happen. I'm assuming that that's true in that case. I'm not getting into the medical specifics. You can all come up with better cases than I can. You could argue that he's actually keeping the body alive longer by managing the fluid. So I asked the question to two different halachic authorities. So one answer was that you're fine. You're keeping the body going so that, yes, eventually they will be able to take the heart, but you're doing the job of keeping the body going. And similarly, Rabbi Usher Weiss, in that same lecture, talked about the case of the anesthesiologist during the abortion, where the abortion is not halakhically mandated or even halakhically allowed. He said the anesthesiologist is just doing his job. He's not involved in the abortion. He's not doing the abortion. The anesthesiologist is simply managing the care of the patient, doing what he does every single day. And therefore, he said that it was fine there. He wasn't the one I asked the question about the organ transplant. But that's one approach. The opposite approach came from the other halakhic authority who I asked, who said, no, you are part of the process of them taking the organ. Without you, they can't do it. And therefore, he argued that it is indeed prohibited. So that's a very important question. This third area, are you able to do your job where your job isn't carrying out the abortion? Your job isn't ending the life of the patient, but it's a necessary piece. That's going to be a very controversial issue. And to me, it's not at all clear cut. Last note. Even if it is lifnei iver, even if it is an issue of causing the patient to, or whoever it is you're giving the advice to, you're causing somebody to stumble, the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg says in source number 15 that there is basis to say one would not need to lose his job to avoid violating lifnei iver. If the price of failure to comply would be that the College of Physicians and Surgeons would say you're no longer allowed to practice here, then Rabbi Waldenberg says it's not so clear that he would have to give up his job to do so. He might be able to give that advice. And that's an important thing that we have to be aware of. So to sum up what we've said, we outlined the major considerations. We said the primary concern is lifnei iver. You're causing people to stumble, which may be mitigated if the advice, the referral, whatever you're doing, is something they could get somewhere else at the same quality and the same cost for which you are providing it. The second consideration was misayeya. Are you assisting somebody in doing something wrong? This seems to be a rabbinic prohibition. And we said there are leniencies if you're helping at a time that is not during the transgression itself, if what you're providing is a background step, where you're doing it for the sake of your salary and your job. And then the third consideration is not to encourage people to do something that is halachically incorrect. In terms of applying it to our cases, so we said when it comes to providing information, if the information is truly available broadly, which again may be a question regarding medical assistance in dying. But if the information is just as available everywhere, and really they go to you because they know you, but it's not as though you're providing something they can't easily get somewhere else, then it would seem not to be a problem of lifnei iver, not to be a problem of misayeya. If what you're doing is referral, and assuming something that is more direct as opposed to the agency, which I think does add a level of distance to this, Rav Asher Weiss believes that it's acceptable, playing in as well the fact that we need to have observant Jewish physicians. If we're talking about playing an indirect role, that becomes much harder. And there, I think it's especially dicey. We see that there are multiple halachic positions on this because your role is so close to what's going on and you're integral to the process. I think there, you really, the whole thing is problematic, but there, you're really in very troubling waters. Noting that, even with Lifnei there, there is the possibility of arguing you wouldn't need to lose your job in order to avoid violation. I want to just close by noting the statement that Rav Asher Weiss made, which I quoted before, about the importance of making sure that we have Jewish physicians. What you do by having doctors who are concerned about halacha, who are concerned about the sensitivities of observant Jews, you are making it possible for our population to be able to manage the medical system and deal with these very difficult and very trying situations. So you know, what you're doing is very important, and we need you to be doing it, and I give you a yashar koach for doing so, and wish you great hatzlacha. Once again, I'll note as we conclude that this is part of the 18-hour shiur. The next shiur is going to be starting shortly. It will be on the Hatizmoret, the orchestra, a story by Shai Agnon. I'll be giving out the story sheets momentarily. For those who are leaving, again, as I noted at the start, well, first of all, again, if you want CME credit, you must sign in. We can't confirm that you are here. We can't give you credit. But also that this is a fundraiser for our programs for university students, and so there are cards by the entrance to the building, and if you're able to contribute something, that's great. If not, this is indeed free of charge. Thank you very much.